Welcome to another episode of Intercontinental Papaya Drama, this time simulcasting in Canada, the USA, and France. Welcome back to another episode of Motorsport 101, the Porsche edition. You thought it was over. Turns out it's only just begun. Again. Hey guys, welcome to episode 535 of Motorsport 101. I'm your friendly neighborhood host, Dre Harrison. And it's time for another IndyCar episode, the last one before they go on a 3-week break of their own for the Olympics, as you do on NBC, new home of the NBA. Oh, God, that's a thing now. I can't stand it, but here we are. But yeah, it's time to review IndyCar's Grand Prix of Toronto, a racetrack that a week ago was literally underwater. It's amazing how quickly things can dry up when the sun comes out again. It's wild, to say the least. Joining me as ever, we got RJ O'Connell and Cam Buckley. RJ, how's it going, man?
It's going good. You know, if I had a nickel for every time an IndyCar race weekend was also overlapped with a major flashpoint in the 2024 U.S. presidential election campaign and cycle, I would have two nickels. Only this time, this nickel isn't getting bumped off of network television to cover the news of aforementioned election cycle. Because if you hadn't heard, Joe Biden is not seeking re-election. His vice president, Kamala Harris, is going to be taking the torch for the Democratic Party in the upcoming election against Republican nominee Donald Trump, who last week had an assassination attempt on his life. Again, overlapping an IndyCar race weekend.
Normal week.
Contrary to what a lot of people thought at the time, as it turns out, the only thing left-wing about that shooter was his aim.
We're going to get some emails.
Oh, my God. It's going to be interesting to see if that stays in. says man who edits these things. Yes, we'll be talking a little bit about IndyCar's Grand Prix in Toronto and Cam Buckley's future assassinated attempt by the time this goes out.
It's all right. If I'm not assassinated now, surely in a moment you will want to.
Depends on who you ask, quite frankly. I love that Kira in our chat just went, and this is why I pay $10.
Well, you can't get this kind of entertainment for free.
No.
You can.
Also from Jason, 360 degree windmill jam from me. Yes.
You can't. Where can you ask me to get a fish sandwich at 4:30 in the morning? You can't get that in Cleveland, but you just might get it on Motorsport 101. It said this fish sandwich is being able to listen to the podcasts as they're being recorded for just $10 a month. If you back us on Patreon.
He's on fire.
Motorsport 101.
Indeed, RJ's got it in one. You can find us on Twitter as well at motorsport_101 or on Instagram, motorsport101pod. Our personal handles, DreHarrison101, at RJ O'Connell, and at CBuckley917. Again, website for all of our details and our written content as well. There's a whole heap of blogs about this race, Formula One's latest Grand Prix in Hungary, and the team order scandal heard around the world, and whether a Red Bull should keep Sergio Perez, because I can't do short columns. 2,500 words of that, wasn't it? It was fun. I had a confidence meter and everything. I turned into a game show host for the day.
Yeah,
and
I could look at it like this.
Yeah.
It could be worse. I have just checked the Red Sox score.
Oh.
This is not as fun because that's not a playoff elimination game and we're not ending a recording.
I would like you to look at it and I need your live reaction because I don't know what this is.
Oh,
I mean, that is kind of bad.
That right there.
That is
my karma.
Oh,
that's
what you get.
Okay. So you're probably wondering like what we're talking about here. So in this special episode of Keeping Up 101, before we get into Toronto, we admittedly dropped off the Formula E World Championship bandwagon. We lost interest as a collective, but we would be doing a disservice if we did not like if we just ignored the championship finale, because we had the ingredients of a good championship finale, and we got a good championship finale in the London E3 doubleheader. So we're going to talk about it, because incredibly enough, Porsche's Pascal Wehrlein is the new Formula E champion of the world, winning it by 7 points after a final race disaster class from Jaguar, which is weird to say about a manufacturer that has just won its first major world championship honor since 1991. But Antonio Felix da Costa in the last race took out Nick Cassidy. Mitch Evans drained his battery from the lead, had two botched attempts to take his final attack mode, and Pascal Wehrlein followed Oliver Hulme from home for the championship win. Wehrlein won race one, finished second in race two. That was enough. And you know what? Good for Pascal Wehrlein. Honestly, love that, love that, love that for Pascal.
He passed some fucking cars.
Look. First and foremost, congratulations to Pascal Wehrlein. He is a good dude. And he was finally able to right the wrongs that Formula One gave him by making Formula E his own. He was a top-tier Formula E driver from the moment he walked into that series. We forget he's still the youngest ever DTM champion. He won that championship when he was 20 years of age. This kid was always an exceptional talent.
And remember, folks, we ain't talking about no GT3 Plus DTM. We're talking Super Silhouette Touring Car DTM. The way DTM used to be.
Indeed. He's made Formula E his home for the last half decade now. Porsche always had the car and powertrain to do this, and this year was the year they finally got a driver over the line. And let's not forget, Antonio Felix da Costa going into London had won 4 out of the previous 5 races, and he was on a hot streak going into that final race. And you know, was eliminated from contention in race 1 out of the weekend. But can I have a minute as a Mitch Evans fan to grieve here for first, just a moment?
I have a gift for you.
What are you going to take the piss out of me now?
Genuine Porsche Championship confetti, fresh from Petit Le Mans 2019's ground.
Fresh, he says.
Kiss my ass, Buckley. You know,
I thought it was in the shape of an L. But yeah, straight.
Also this.
Yeah, look. This is the third championship decider that Mitch Evans has been in, and he's 0-3 in all 3 championship deciders. 2021, his car stalls on the grid due to an electrical fault, and Ennio Mortara drives into him from behind, head down, gearbox up, etc. 2022, he has a shot in London, but his powertrain dies and he has to park it on the side of the road. And now 2024, we had a sketchy attack mode activation, which apparently Mitch missed the gate for. I'm still not sure how he missed it. Mitch doesn't know how he missed it.
He cut, the entry on that more on the time where it actually activated.
It doesn't make any sense. And the time before when he tried, he was in the middle of his activation when Scott Elkins dropped the safety car for a crash that had happened already with Cassidy, who sadly was taken out of the race due to a puncture that we...
Yeah, remember like a few rounds ago when Cassidy was like odds-on favorite to win the title?
That did not last.
Yeah. Cassidy had a 35-point lead and he ended up blowing it all. And it wasn't even on him. Cassidy was in a great spot halfway through this race. He was in third. He'd taken both his attack modes. Both Evans and Wehrlein in front of him had yet to take theirs yet. And then, and with da Costa coming through the field, he got to the top 5, got to the back of Cassidy's car, missed his braking point, hit the back of Cassidy's car and punctured a tire. And that effectively ended Cassidy's race and championship. I actually feel horrible for da Costa because he and Cassidy are very close friends. And apparently when they saw each other, they both broke down in tears and hugged each other. And just da Costa was apparently extremely apologetic. Just said that he didn't want to ruin anybody's championship. Of course, he was going to try and help Wehrlein wherever he could, but not like that, obviously. I've heard nothing but good things about the cost of the human being in the paddock. I know he would never do something like that on purpose, especially to a very good friend of his.
It's close quarters racing, and it's
extremely close.
It's two close quarters racing.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I'm gutted for Cassidy. I'm gutted for Evans, who has become the Stirling Moss of Formula E, the easily the best driver it's ever had that's not won a championship in that series. Three deciders, 0-3 in all three of them. And I do not for the life of me know how Jaguar was playing it with Mitch. Cam, you've got to give me this here. That strategy with Evans' car, I do not understand. What was the plan here?
They more or less put him in a situation, like, we thought that the energy was going to be all right. In the end, it was not. They basically just had, I think their strategy was basically, do not let Wehrlein get to the point. If he gets to the lead, we're beaten. And given the pace that Wehrlein had for most of the race, they might have had a point. But having Evans lead the whole race, he was on such a shortfall of energy that he had to back off on the final lap. Yeah. And Wehrlein had everyone around him dead to rights on energy.
Yeah. Shout out to Oliver Rowland, who actually won that race in the end. And
Oliver for Rowland.
Nissan, not dead.
Nissan were great this year overall. Oliver Rowland had a fantastic season for what it's worth. Like, Oliver Rowland, pound for pound, was as good as anybody in this championship this year, in my humble opinion.
One of the drivers of the year in this series.
Just absolutely frustrates me that Sasha Fenestraz isn't at that level.
No, but I thought he would be, but Rowland has become the de facto leader of that team and was genuinely on a championship campaign until he missed Portland due to sickness. If he was in that Portland weekend, he would have had a genuine shot at the title. No doubt about it. Real gutted for Rowland as well. Mitch is one of the good dudes in racing. Like, I remember when he didn't win it in 22 when he lost out to Stoffel. And again, those two are also very close friends, and they were just sitting there chilling like it was just another day at the office. People love Mitch, and I'm gutted for him. Congrats to Pascal. I was very fortunate to be able to meet him a couple of days later in an interview for Autosport, which is due out in a couple of weeks' time. And I actually did tell Pascal about that finale and watching that. Said, I'm going to be honest, Pascal, this is nothing against you. It's just Mitch Evans is one of my favorite drivers, and I'm gutted he didn't win. And he giggled to himself and he said, nah, I get it. Like, Mitch is a really good dude, so like, I understand why you're gutted for him, but I had to win it.
It's vindication for Wehrlein's talent, because we talked about his time in Formula One. Like, he came in with a reputation of his person meter that I think was grossly overinflated, and that might have something to do with the amount of melanin in his skin, but that's not here nor there. But he did some great work with underfunded teams. Like, he got points with Manor. He scored points with Sauber with a neck injury that everybody thought it was too soft to race through.
With a neck injury, not only that, remember that Sauber was rocking the previous year's Ferrari engine. That thing was a boat anchor.
And in an alternate timeline, perhaps he's the replacement for Nico Rosberg when he hangs it up. But Mercedes won an experience, and they want to be risk averse.
Understandable. And Bottas was fine for a good few years when he was there at Mercedes. He was a great team player, and given the heat that had come off Hamilton and Rosberg's relationship, he was kind of what Mercedes needed. They needed a docile team player, you know, solid pair of hands in the second seat that would still keep roughly the same floor and just let Hamilton cook. And it worked out fine for 4 years after the fact. So, you know, it doesn't
make it any less painful that a tremendously talented young man effectively got ushered out of Formula One.
It's a shame.
At the same time, with the death of Manor as well, because all the promise going into 2017 with fresh regulations, with actual money behind them, that money disappeared and the team was no more.
Yeah, it's just one of them things, man. And look, I was able to say it to his face that, look, F1 wronged you, and I'm really glad you've got a world championship that you can call your own. And he's a genuinely lovely lad, and you know, a good guy. He ran late for us as when he didn't have to do that. That's just the sort of the guy he is. He's a class act, and I'm delighted for him. And I'm not just saying that because I'm a bitter Mitch fan. He's a genuinely good dude, and I'm really glad that if it wasn't going to be Mitch, I'm glad it was Pascal at least, because he's a good dude. And he's a fantastic ambassador for the series and for what falling up from F1 can do for a guy sometimes. And that's it should be a feel-good story about a series that I wish I felt better about, because that was another hot mess. Watching London reminded me as to why I don't watch this series anymore, because it was the driving standards in that weekend were largely appalling.
How telling is it that one of the press images was a throne made out of discarded car parts?
Okay, it's better than them dropping a car from an airplane.
Just about.
The bar is resting with the Titanic.
The bar is resting somewhere beneath the floor of the episode.
You know where it isn't resting? With friend of the show and guest of the show in preseason, Sasha Garlick. They got it right.
Well done to them. Well done to Sasha. Well done to Sasha Garlick. You got both the team's winner and the Drivers' Championship winner absolutely bang on. We all predicted Jaguar to win the team title, and they did. And they actually won the brand new Manufacturer's Trophy, because DaCosta's time penalty for hitting Cassidy actually knocked Porsche off the top spot in the Manufacturer's Trophy and gave it to Jaguar. I suppose
there's a cost for everything.
Like, Jake Dennis won the world championship last year, and he drove like a complete pillock in race one, where he got into three separate smashes and picked up four penalty points in one weekend.
Yeah, he drove like a jackass this weekend. Can't even lie.
Yeah.
Sometimes the Jake struggles can be self-inflicted. I don't know. Drake, someone ask you.
Oh, God.
It's clear, like, Formula E, we're not as hot as we once were. We said a lot of negative things about the series, and as it stands, we don't have any plans to cover the series full time next season, 2024-2025. Do you think if the standard improves, could we have a place for it again?
I am a never say never kind of person, so I will always leave the door open. If the series is captivating, I've got no problem covering it if we've got the time and measures to be able to do so. Just to clarify, because people have asked me about this, and maybe I've not been clear enough in other places. Understandable, we're not a big name website, and I've talked about it here and there. The reason why I steered away from covering it is because I was just so down on the series for its style of racing and its poor coverage that I don't think it was worthy of our time of day. And we sat through Berlin's weekend, and Berlin at Tempelhof is normally the blue ribbon Formula E round, the weekend where it normally always delivers a great race or two. And we just got fed up watching that race in real time with just the amount of collisions, the amount of sloppy driving, the close quarters, quote, peloton racing that the series wants to promote so badly. We didn't enjoy it. It moved beyond the realm of fun chaos into fuck off chaos. And that's, like, for me personally, I wouldn't have watched it if it wasn't for the fact that it was that I already paid for Discovery Plus for its MotoGP coverage, which is what TNT Sports has on their network. If it wasn't for that, I would not have gone out of my way to pay the £30 a month to watch it legally, because it wasn't on free-to-air TV anymore.
Yeah.
I didn't agree with them hiring Jermaine Genius as their lead anchor, who's a footballer and not a particularly good football broadcaster in the first place. And I think they completely missed the mark with some of the names they put in the box to commentate, like David Coulthard, who, I'm sorry, didn't come off like a knowledgeable pundit at all. The racing was, in my opinion, poor. It was.
Weird thing about the racing. It's either you get a NASCAR drafting race turned up to 12, or you get close quarters with cars that are that have outgrown the tracks in which they race on. Now, I personally, I would prefer it if they stuck to street tracks. I would prefer it if they did not like make an all-in push on permanent road course. I understand why they're doing it, but I would also like to see them like try again with bigger tracks that are better suited for these cars. And look, maybe something will change if they get fast charging software. And this is not to say like there's nothing of value in Formula E, because there is.
No, absolutely.
There's a great of amazing drivers who I'm sure would have opportunities to race elsewhere, but they're going to compensate handsomely.
There's too many instances this year of like, I felt like I needed to go lie down after an FE race, and not for no good reasons.
Right.
As mentioned, it went beyond the point of fun chaos and fun silly and into questioning the seriousness of the championship.
Like, at least with Moto 2 and Moto 3 and World Superbikes dropping off it from time to time, it's just like, well, we're trying to streamline the product. We're trying to streamline a podcast, and we can't talk about too much.
Yeah, it's we try to keep to an hour roughly, and you know, there's only so many series we can watch and cover. We don't want to do 14 podcasts a week. We're all juggling full-time work at the end of the day, me in particular. I would rather not have to spend my entire week looking at audio waveforms.
I'm the lazy bum of this podcast.
But even so,
I mean,
we have to draw the line somewhere, and we already cover three series full time. We cover the other big one-offs like Le Mans as well when need be, and we dabble in other series here and there. We do it because we love motorsport, and we don't love where Formula E is at right now. And that's not to say it can't improve, and but I am fed up with a lot of what the series is doing on the track and off the track. And it's a shame because, as RJ says, there is plenty of redeeming things about that series. The roster is excellent. I know there's a lot of hardworking people, and I want to see how far electric technology goes. I will always be fascinated by the tech and the know-how of what the series can do. But I think from an action standpoint, it has plateaued. I think attack mode is redundant at this point. I know we're going to be going to fast charging pit stops next year if the technology works. Maybe that'll be injured. Maybe that will change the racing.
But, or maybe they push it back again. Who knows?
For me, it was far too formulaic, and I didn't enjoy the direction of the product, and I didn't like the disingenuous marketing tactics of the series to pretend like it was pro cycling. Because as someone that watched all of this year's Tour de France, congrats to Tadej Pogačar, by the way, no, it is not peloton racing. Stop calling it that. Anyone who watches cycling will tell you that is not how peloton racing works.
Okay, I love me some Pascal Wehrlein, but he didn't put in performances like my good friend Tadej Pogačar did at the Tour.
So, to answer you guys' questions about it, never say never, but for now, I would rather cover F1, MotoGP, and IndyCar as our three big series on this show going forward. And we'll see what happens. If there's enough demand for it and you guys really want to listen to it next year, or even this year, because the first race is in December next season. So good luck to them. But for now, we don't think it's worth the time.
It's not you, it's me. Or maybe it's just us.
We're going to have to start season preview season before the season even ends.
It's so stupid. Should we talk about IndyCar now?
Yeah,
finally, this IndyCar episode gets to the IndyCar.
Yeah, 23 minutes in, as you do. After this, let's talk about IndyCar's Grand Prix of Toronto.
Folks, the suffering is finally over. Colton Herta finally won a race with his superior track position and dominant pace. He dominated the Ontario Honda Dealers Grand Prix of Toronto, sort of. Yes, he did become the first IndyCar driver ever to lead every single session of a weekend, all practices, qualifying, and the warm-up. But he didn't have a lot of time to stretch his legs because of two big incidents at the start and at the end. But at the end of the day, after 800 days, 41 races, and a win at the Sebring 12 Hours at his side gig, Colton Herta held off his teammate Kyle Kirkwood to take the victory, his first since the 2022 Indianapolis Grand Prix.
It's about damn time.
Yes. I'll kick this one off. I mean, as I've said many a time on this show, Colton Herta's speed and talent has never been the problem. He has had that from day literally one. This is a guy that won an IndyCar race as a teenager. Like,
this is the guy who, in his first trip to the Indy 500, trimmed that thing out, was the fastest Honda in qualifying.
Yeah, the guy is an incredible talent. So, like, it's hard to get a look in with IndyCar sometimes because the top end of the field is so good and has so many quality drivers. It's hard to stand out. We've been mad at Colton Herta because he's generally under-delivered since his rookie season in terms of how good we know he can be in this series. So for him to go 41 races and go over 2 years since his last stop is unthinkable, in my opinion.
I think what makes it so much worse is that he has been in position to win so many times and very often he's made a mess of it all on his own.
Yeah.
A couple times this year, even, because this year, the Andretti's speed, at least at the top end, has been back and he has been the spearhead of that organization.
Yeah, it's back to the Andretti of probably 2 or 3 years ago where they are challenging for wins and they have one genuine title contender in Colton Herta and another that's probably just outside of that in
Carl Kirkwood. And a car that's cursed.
And a car that's cursed because Marcus Ericsson is just extra strugglicious right now and it's not all on him. But this was the Colton Herta that we thought could be an F1 star one day.
Yeah, this is the guy that you think, you know, he doesn't have the license points, but maybe if you were to take that gamble, you could get a little something more than what you could get out of Logan Sargeant. To be fair, not all of Logan Sargeant's problems are all on Logan Sargeant, but I digress. At the end of 2021, Colton Herta came out of that season looking hotter than fish grease, and after winning the Brickyard Grand Prix that year, in the conditions that he won it, you think, well, there is absolutely no stopping this dude. And I always thought, when Helmut Marko first thought of him as an AlphaTauri replacement, and looking back, I just think, like, he's never been able to, like, it felt like an unbearable weight that was just hanging around his neck for no reason.
I find it startling that it's been this long, and I joked about this when I wrote about it. That was the most dominant, least dominant race win I've ever seen in IndyCar. Like I said, I was actually startled when they put up the stat that that's never been done in IndyCar, that someone has led every single session of a race weekend, which is amazing for a Grand Prix where Herta won by 4/10 of a second.
Again, yeah. he didn't really have an opportunity to stretch his legs. There were enough incidents to where he didn't really have the time to build like a 5, 10, 15 second lead like he did at
Long Beach. Well, he was never in position to because Kirkwood was shadowing him all the way.
Yeah, Kirkwood could drive.
Yeah, for this, you know, fairly dominant Herta performance, Kirkwood was basically shadowing him every single lap.
Yeah,
kind of half acting as a rear gunner, but he never really looked like he was going to take a shot at Colton for the win.
I don't think Kirkwood was ever more than 1.9 seconds back the entire race, and it was only a tenth behind him in qualifying. That might be, and this is weird coming for a guy that has won two IndyCar races already. That might be Kyle Kirkwood's most impressive drive.
What if I told you that was Kyle Kirkwood's first podium in 2024?
That would feel weird
because he's been really solid this year.
He's had two performances outside of the top 10 all year in IndyCar. He was 11th at the Indianapolis Grand Prix, and he was 16th in Iowa Race 2. He's been in the top 10 the entire year outside of that, but strangely, that was his first podium finish. It's like the upper ceiling's not quite there with Kirkwood until this past weekend. That was an That was the most consistently excellent Kyle Kirkwood's been in an IndyCar for a whole weekend.
Well, and the other thing as well, a number of times, even though this his ceiling might not have been there, he has been Andretti's ceiling on a number of occasions this year.
That was crazy. He's having the year that we thought Marcus Ericsson would be having this car. When you just look at results on a Wikipedia page, and I know that's like a pitfall, but like Kyle Kirkwood, if you need a top 10, he'll get you a top 10. If you need to get a top 5, he'll get you either a top 10 or a top 5. And today he'll get you a podium.
Yeah. Nice little bonus prize for a guy who's deserved the podium all year long for how well he's driven. Like I said, Kirkwood was shadow boxing with Herta all weekend long, qualifying, race trim, restarts. Kirkwood didn't want to take a huge gamble to go for the win by taking a lunge down the bottom of the back straight. He took the 40 points and went home in second, which is, I think, smart driving. You don't want to risk it with your teammate like that necessarily. And he was content to take the 1-2. Great drive from Kyle Kirkwood. Very, very impressive. Running down the field a little bit as well, Scott Dixon, 15th to 3rd. Alex Palou, somehow, 18th to 4th.
Can I be quite clear for just a moment? Luigi finishes 4th by doing nothing. Alex Palou is dominating this title just because he put his controller down and watched everyone else go flying off.
Learned from Iowa. He learned from his mistake in Iowa.
He learned from Iowa where he finished 2nd in the second race there.
Good strategy and clean driving was enough. It was enough on the day to get him back to stretching that championship lead out.
They told the Chip Ganassi cars, run long. It turns out the overcut was the effective strategy in Toronto rather than in Hungary, where it was the undercut, because Dixon ran 4 laps longer. And actually, the tire wear was so little that just skipping that heating up phase
got on the black Dixon, tires, at least. The green tires were made of chewing gum.
Chewing gum. But the black tire runs brought them into play. And just, again,
Dixon's opening black tire run.
Phenomenal.
Damn. Phenomenal. Vintage Dixon. Can I also say, we have now found the true unstoppable force. Dixon did kind of blast Canapino into the wall during this race.
A little bit, yeah.
Do you think his fans dare speak up in the face of Emma Davies Dixon?
Fuck no. Emma Davies Dixon is lighting her axe on fire like she's playing Dark Souls 3. We are not going down this road. Like, the unstoppable force of Canapino fans will meet the immovable object of Emma Davies Dixon's axe.
Brandishing an axe. But yeah, his path to word was, his path to third was a little bit soaked in blood there. Because good lord.
Just a little bit. And Palou, he just ran long in the second stint and was able to make the most out of the green tires, got back out in front of the pack, and then just watched as everybody else took each other out, which brings us into our second major point here, because the race was hampered by a big accident at the end of the race, with Pato O'Ward spinning into the outside wall at turn one, being joined by Marcus Ericsson, who also went backwards into that wall a little bit later on, about 3 seconds later, before, well, the front of Pato O'Ward's car is sticking out on the exit of that corner, and it turns out Pietro Fittipaldi hit it and went into the outside wall. Santino Ferrucci launched off it and ended up half in the catch fence by the time his car hit the ground again, and Nolan Siegel, who smashed off the inside and went into the inside wall, he was hit from behind by Toby Sowery as well. It was a 5-car wreck that led to a red flag while they cleaned everything up. Thankfully, everybody involved was okay, with various degrees of car damage, but nothing serious, thankfully. Race control got roasted over the coals for this one for allegedly delaying the caution. Apparently, Gavin Ward felt sick watching it. Pato O'Ward complained about it on Twitter. Fans were not happy.
It's a big, big accident that just seemed to escalate from just, Pato spun the car, and just immediately it's like, holy Jesus, we have a car in the catch fence. Like, I don't like Santino Ferrucci, but I also don't like when drivers get seriously hurt. I'm glad he's fine, but you absolutely blew it on the flyaway meme that you put up on socials because you didn't even sink the point where Lenny Kravitz sees fly away to your car going up in the air. But I digress.
Needs more work in the Adobe suite. Kind of echoing the statement. Yeah, the crash just escalated from there. First point on the matter. That is really shockingly terrible from Pato O'Ward if we're evaluating him in the context of a title contender.
And he already had got into trouble in turn one when he actually punted Ferrucci into the wall on the opening lap and broke his front wing. And he wasn't criticized for that one so much, but yeah, he bottled it, for lack of a better term. Straight up, Pato was right behind him into turn.
Missed the corner.
He's missed the corner, spun out entirely, had complete loss of control of the car, piss poor mistake, backwards into the wall. And not that we knew it at the time, but race over, essentially, only because of what happened next. Now, the question on my script was this mismanaged by IndyCar? Because a lot of people wrote about it. I know Elizabeth Blackstock wrote a piece about it for Planet F1. My response is, race control was not the issue on this one. I've watched the footage back multiple times. Amazingly, because you got to remember, TV graphics can be a little bit slow compared to real time to update themselves. There was a full course caution within 6 seconds of Pato hitting the wall. I can't blame race control. They did act as fast as they reasonably could have done on this one. Unfortunately, the way Toronto is structured, there are some problems. There is no lights between the breaking point of turn one until you get to the exit of the corner towards the back straight. And there's only a couple of marshal holes with fumes operating them. And it takes obviously a few seconds to change to having a yellow flag out as you're passing through that section. So you're going by fuming reaction time on that. You know me on this show. I've been the first guy to roast race control and new arsehole in IndyCar. This is not the one. This is a fundamental problem of Toronto as a racetrack, not with race control itself. That's my take on the matter.
I think they could do with more. Obviously, I think more side postage wouldn't hurt.
No.
More LED lights at the side in places like that, because that turn one has not changed since they started racing here in 1986.
It's a terrible corner.
The only component of the circuit that they have changed is coming out of turn 8 and 9, we have slightly reprofiled the last right-left sequence and changed up the pit lane, and that's more due to the things that are around. This is a temporary street track in a sporting complex.
To bring back a legendary motorsport quote, whoever designed this first corner needs to be taken into a dark room and beat about the head.
I wouldn't go that far. It's a trouble spot, but
it's consistently one of the worst corners in IndyCar.
We've been racing at this corner for 40 years.
And it's been terrible for 40 years.
It sucks. It's a funnel. It's a horrible corner. You can go 5.
Long Beach turn one is a funnel.
Yeah, and I don't like that corner very much. Long Beach
turn one is a corner. There's hardly any straight track that doesn't funnel down into the first quarter like this, or the first couple of quarters.
But then why does this keep happening in Toronto then, where guys are going 5 wide on restarts into the first corner when they know it's only a 2-car exit at most?
Because they know that there are limited opportunities to gain track position.
Then reprofile the goddamn corner, because honestly, it's got too many blind spots in it. And for some reason, we do this every year where somebody will try a 3 wide on the exit of that corner, and one driver at least is going in the fence and their day is over. We saw it on the first lap of the race where Christian Rasmussen was punted into the wall by Marcus Ericsson and Ferrucci broke his front wing at Pato O'Ward's expense. This happens every year at Toronto, and it's stupid. Like, it's embarrassing. I'm at what point do we go, the track is partly responsible for the errors that it creates? Like, I'm trying to give IndyCar's drivers the benefit of the doubt, because normally I'm the first person to rip them a new arsehole. Like, at what point do we go, this is a pattern of behavior?
It's tough, right? Because, like, we saw that incidents can also happen, like, further up the track. Like, Will Power cleaned out Scott McLaughlin
No. Penske pressed the self-destruct button in spectacular fashion this weekend.
Yeah, Jesus Christ.
To say, not in a million years, not in a billion years, not in a trillion years, Will Power. That move was never on. And I'm happy that they went beyond the normal drop to the back of the line penalty and actually decided to give him a full blown drive through when they went back to green. Horrible, horrible overtake attempt. And
McLaughlin sarcastically clapped as Power drove by a lap afterwards when they came through again. And McLaughlin was, he was very diplomatic about it afterwards when he calmed down, but he said, this was a low percentage move. We're both in front of Alex Palou. Why are you dive bombing me?
They were both going to take more points out of Palou on a weekend where Chip Ganassi qualified very poorly. And instead, Palou is laughing all the way to the bank.
Yep. Because with that fourth place, he's back up to having a 49-point lead. He's basically got a weekend in hand again. If he can survive Gateway, he's got Portland next, which he's won twice around before. One of his strongest rounds on paper.
We're talking about survive Gateway. I mean, he finished second in his last oval finish.
Yeah.
And I don't think he's going to overexert himself the way he did from his previous oval non-finish. Are you closing a full race gap in 5 weekends remaining on a guy whose floor is this high?
The reason I'm saying no is because we have 3 ovals to close out the year, and anything can fucking happen on an oval, as we saw in Iowa. Like,
yeah.
Powell won a race from 22nd purely off a delayed caution and dumb luck.
Then also was the only Penske to finish today, even after getting a drive-through penalty, because his damage was less severe than everybody else's.
Joseph Newgarden, having a good weekend on a road course for the first time maybe all year, and then goes and proves all the doubters, the haters, the naysayers categorically correct.
The championship is categorically over for him.
Yeah.
He's now.
If there is one guarantee, it's that Joseph Newgarden's not winning the title at this point.
He's 145 points off the top with 5 races to go. He's 8th in the standings right now behind Kyle Kirkwood, and a long way back from Kyle Kirkwood. It would be a miracle if Newgarden finishes the season higher than 8th.
He would need to basically win out from here to have any shot.
And even then, that might not be enough.
He would have to win out from here, and people would have to have issues in front of him for him to really make big moves on the points.
But he won the 500.
Yep, got the second board winner.
A price for everything.
Ended up being a race where just you just had to survive to get good results. Just like the top McLaren finisher in this race, Théo Pourchaire. Wait, what?
Théo Pourchaire?
I thought they fired him. That's right. So Friday in practice, Alexander Rossi hurt his thumb. He went wide through a corner, crashed, couldn't get hand off the steering wheel time, broke his thumb. So he was ruled out, as we're all thinking, who on earth could McLaren possibly get in this time of need to replace Alexander Rossi? Because many of the usual suspects are either racing in Indianapolis like Connor Daly, or dealing with a back problem like Jack Harvey, or hadn't raced in a while like Benjamin Peterson or Devlin DeFrancesco or Oliver Askew. And as it turns out, the solution was right under our nose. Théo Pourchaire was shipped out of Paris, out of France, to Frankfurt, Germany, to Toronto in less than 24 hours to make it to qualifying with less than 2 hours to spare, meaning his first on-track action in Ontario was qualifying for the race. He finished 14th, a lap down, but he still finished for a team that recently fired him because he couldn't be all their own, because he's still technically under contract with Team Hinweil for Formula One, an opportunity that I know they'll never give him.
What is this team? What is McLaren International?
You know, I'll say this. Tao had one shot and one opportunity to impress, and by all accounts, he maximized what he could this weekend.
Would you take it, or would you just let it slip?
Look.
Where do we start with McLaren?
First of all, best wishes to Alex Rossi. I don't say that lightly as a fellow podcaster. He's since had surgery on his broken thumb that he suffered because he had a nasty crash in Friday practice when he hit the outside pit lane wall. It's a Toronto classic hitting that outside wall. We've all done it once. Unfortunately, he didn't get his hands off the wheel and he broke his thumb doing it. So they had to fly Rossi back to Indiana so he could get surgery on that thumb. His ETA to return is unknown. He might be back for Gateway after the Olympic break. We'll have to wait and see. Thankfully, I'm really glad that McLaren are normally really, really good with drivers and empathy with them whenever they suffer hand injuries. Anyway, moving on.
How much do you think they looked at David Malouk's finishing ahead of all three of them, and just like Zach Brown, who was there, is just like
the least controversial here. Part of McLaren's weekend across all of their series was the little hits of papaya on Kyle Larson's car on that contrived ass finish over in Indianapolis.
Oh yeah, I mean, look, the way I see it, I find it funny because there was hints and then we got confirmation that Oliver Askew was in that IndyCar paddock on Friday and Devlin DeFrancesco was already in Toronto, ready to go to potentially fill in if necessary. They scrambled around late Friday night to call up Teo Pourchaire, a man who they deemed was not good enough to be in the number six car, and they fired 40 days after saying we've signed you for the rest of the season, and then had the cheek to tell him, well, it was nothing to do with you. We just thought Siegel was better than you, and we had to sign him now and develop him now. And only 2 days after he'd gone back home from the United States, because apparently he stuck around in the US for a little while, gave RLL a visit, because, you know, tried to work avenues about a potential future seat somewhere. He'd only just got back to France for a couple of days. And Tony Kanaan has the audacity, in between arguing with fans on Twitter who have made perfectly reasonable points about their bullshit hiring practices, is now desperately saying, hey, hey Teddy, it's Tony here, buddy. Do you mind cutting us one more solid? What the fuck?
If someone calls you up for a solid out of nowhere, you know that it ain't it. This whole thing.
It's laughable.
Why McLaren? Why are you the way that you are? Because if it was an isolated incident, you could understand. If it was like a second time, this is like the fifth major driver contract related nonsense story we've had out of this camp in under a year.
I'd say it goes deeper than that. It goes back to James Hinchcliffe being told not to go to work because we didn't like what you did on the ESPN body issue.
Oh, even better, James Hinchcliffe being told, you have a contract for next year. We didn't say anything about it being a driving contract.
They bring in Pat O'Ward and Oliver Askew. They fire Oliver Askew for lying about racing with a concussion, which, again,
that's understandable. That's an understandable situation.
Although the handshakes for that would have been equally as awkward as it was with Teo Pourchaire.
Yeah.
We get to Felix Rosenqvist. They're trying to tell him desperately to do anything else but drive a McLaren IndyCar, but because we got Alex Palou, except they don't have Alex Palou. So they bring in David Malouk as a backup option, and no, he's hurt his wrist, and we have contractual agreements, so we got to let him go. But we don't have anybody else in line. So here is Teo Pourchaire. We're going to get him, except he's not actually ours because he's still got Sauber commitments. So we're getting Nolan Siegel.
It was bullshit, though. Like, listen. I know Tony can use the excuse that Paul Scher was never really ours, but Paul Scher had been a Sauber Academy driver for 3 years and had never considered putting him in the F1 car over Zhou Guanyu. They made their bed 3 years ago on that shit. It was more than obvious they weren't going to use Paul Scher. Even more so, they doubled down on that at the start of this year by hiring Zane Maloney to be another Academy driver that they're likely not going to use.
So because Audi wants experience hands. All of this,
that's why they just hired Mattia Binotto.
I feel awful for Teo Porcher that he's being dragged around like this. You know, I think now he's at the point where he's like, he's unfairly evaluated for being, you know, a terrible third year champion, despite being, you know, younger than some first year champions in Formula 2.
This point before about McLaren on the show.
Yeah.
How can you hope to be a consistent championship threat if you have this degree of instability in your team?
And I don't disagree. Injury is one thing.
Injury is one thing. But you don't have an excuse on this scenario when you have four other scenarios of just dicking around with contracts, throwing out napkin contracts to anyone who will listen, getting jerked around by Alex Palou. All of the, like, who is running McLaren's legal department?
And why does Tony Kanaan have that much clout? And why can't he log off Twitter?
Why is Tony Kanaan seemingly the first and last name in their contractual disputes now? And why are you getting into beef on Twitter over it with racing fans who, I mean, take it from me, I'm a racing fan. We don't know anything.
Like, I love me some Tony Kanaan, but that wasn't on. And like, it's a whole, like,
it's just a bad look.
There's this whole McLaren IndyCar team is a mess. And like, I really hope Nolan Siegel starts putting in the performances that I know deep down he's capable of. Otherwise, are you they're not going to cut bait?
He's not looking great right now.
He's looking like,
because he's just
a teenage driver that's been thrust way ahead of development schedule
into the third team that he's been in under a year. The only stability and constant in this team is Pato O'Ward, who just chucked his car at a wall, and with it, his championship chances have taken a massive hit.
I don't know. It's just like, we've talked enough about McLaren.
I'm tired of talking about McLaren always being a Honda S2000. Potential. They're all about the potential, and they never fucking realize it because they have no stability.
It's not even the potential for me. For me, it's more about the fact that it's just mismanagement.
They're treating drivers disposably.
They're disposing of drivers left, right, and center in IndyCar. And like I said, the audacity for them to call Paul Scher after the way they treated him, in my opinion, is laughable. And in Formula One, they can't manage a race to save their lives. Like, it's just, I need a McLaren to stop being so fucking newsworthy and not in a good way either. Like, it's just
Be more boring.
Be boring. You do not have to be the excitement every single goddamn time. It's ridiculous.
It doesn't have to be Ron Dennis getting his gravel washed or calling windows illumination fixtures. But more boring than what you are now.
I guess if we didn't have this, we wouldn't have much to talk about some days. I don't know.
But when I talk about potential, I look at it from a perspective. If Pato O'Ward is your guy, he's your championship spearhead.
Yeah.
He does not have he is doing himself no favors right now.
None. He's now 70 points back again.
And you have no cars in the fight. You have no other cars to go take points off of the Palous and Dixons and Powers. Not that Power needed any help to take points off of himself this weekend. if you want a rear gunner for Pato to be able to go take it to a championship fight and take points off of other guys, you need to have something resembling stability.
But then we get this guy. Isn't this what we free Christian Lundgaard for?
You free Christian, yeah, and watch that go to shit too.
It better not. I'm going to be very upset about it.
You thought you freed him. You were wrong.
Indeed.
I hope not. We're going to go watch some Olympics.
Yeah, let's go eat a
burger.
Let's do both of those things instead. IndyCar is back in 3 weeks' time. They're in the middle of their Olympic break on NBC. They'll be back on August 17th, my 32nd birthday, for the Grand Prix of Gateway. So looking forward to that after the break. Just 5 rounds to go in IndyCar this season. And 4 of them are ovals. Gateway, Portland, 2 races in Milwaukee, and then Nashville Super Speedway to close out the year. So don't put too much into that championship table, because boy, we have a lot to get through before that's ironed out. We're back for Gateway on that one. Formula One, we'll be back, as mentioned, with the Belgian Grand Prix this weekend at Spa, and we will talk about that on next week's show. So until then, I've been Dre Harrison, they've been Cam Buckley and RJ O'Connell. Until next time, thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you next time. Sayonara.
Later, y'all.
Despite everyone else's best efforts, it's looking more and more... pull over.